Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Barry Eichengreen and also Ira Harris. Barry is professor of economics and political science at the University of California, Berkeley, and a former senior policy advisor at the International Monetary Fund. He's written a number of books, including Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar, and The Future of the International Monetary System. Also, How Global Currencies Work, Past, Present, and Future. And also, The Populist Temptation, Economic Grievance and Political Reaction in the Modern Era. His most cited paper is Bayoumi and Eichengreen, Shocking Aspects of European Monetary Unification in 1993, which argued that the European Union was less suitable as a single currency area than the United States. This diagnosis was confirmed in 2011 when external shocks caused the Eurozone crisis. Ira is an independent trader, successful hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. And it's really an honor to be here with the professor. I've read his works for many, many years, and I great respect his studies on the gold impact in the 1920s and 30s and what went wrong, and some of my favorite reading over the years. So it's really an honor.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a quote from a recent essay published by Barry back in April 10th on Project Syndicate. He writes, in fact, Chinese policymakers have broader motives because China has a higher export to GDP ratio than the U.S. They are more concerned with preserving the global trading system. By eschewing escalation, China avoids jeopardizing it. And by appealing to the WTO, World Trade Organization, it positions itself as a champion of free and open trade. It demonstrates constructive leadership of the multilateral system. Ira, you wrote that in the blog, and just wondering your thoughts when you wrote that.
Well, you know, I like to read what's on Project Syndicate, and I know that Professor Eichengreen is there at times. And this one caught my eye because it deflated all the hysteria that was running around. And because, you know, as I wrote right in the blog, that, you know, because people have left, right, you know, they look at the world through binary eyes. And, you know, Richard, I certainly, in my path that I've taken over the years in this business, I there's nothing binary. And Professor Eichengreen's historical analysis on many issues is so good. And it has great relevance to people who trade and invest if they would bother to sit back and contemplate some of what he said. So I wanted the people who read my blog to understand that there was a whole other view to this rather than the hysteria that fills the financial news either in print or on electronic media. So it was very important to do that.
And Barry, what were your thoughts when you wrote that essay, Can a Trade War Be Averted?
I stand by that passage that you read, Richard. I think it is true that, if anything, China has even more to lose from a trade war than the United States, because exports are a larger share of GDP for China than for the U.S. Chinese manufacturing relies even more heavily on imported parts and components than is the case here. And Chinese officials do have broader motives in the sense that they can position themselves as guardians of the global system and make friends as defenders of multilateralism. But I think I like even more another passage that you didn't quote, where I said, even if China has more to lose from a trade war than the United States, there are no winners. It's kind of like an exchange of nuclear weaponry. Both sides lose. I think that is still the case. I'm hopeful that China's calibrated response and some second thoughts in the White House will bring us back from the brink. But if we don't pull back from the brink, things could be very bad.
And what do you think about the U.S. administration in terms of levying the tariffs? Are they simply bluffing and using this as a bargaining chip on trade treaty negotiations to get the U.S. a better deal?
It's clearly being used as a bargaining chip, and the hope throughout has been evidently that threats of tariff increases will bring Chinese officials to the table and some kind of negotiated solution will follow from that. It's of a piece with how we approach the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. Trump threatened to tear it up. That brought the Koreans to the table, and some relatively minor but notable concessions were reached about opening up the Korean automobile market to U.S. exports, about some provisions for mutual oversight of exchange rates. I think the same is again true of NAFTA, that there were a lot of threats about tearing up the agreement, and now it looks like there will be a successful renegotiation with concessions on all sides. The difference in the China case is that we're not offering any concessions and we're asking them only of the Chinese. Another difference, I think, is that even more than South Korea or Canada or Mexico, China responds negatively to threats and external pressure. This strategy has worked to an extent with other countries. That's no guarantee it'll work with China.
Your thoughts, Ira?
No, it's really interesting to hear Professor Eichengreen's views on that. I think that, you know, again, having read and studied this when I was back in university and graduate school, I really had the pleasure of studying a lot about China I was at the graduate school in Madison with Ed Friedman, who I've always had great respect for, and his thoughts on China. I think that's absolutely right. And I think the Chinese are not given enough credit for how they stepped to fill the void during the so-called Great Financial Crisis, and that they took on a lot of the world's burden at the time by, of course, you know, now they're being accused of having too much debt. But they were the ones who they did fill the void when everybody went into contraction. So they're not going to sit willy-nilly and say, hey, you know what? Yeah, we're going to be the whipping boy. We're just going to accept it. So which was my point of citing this article, because I thought it was so important, because it makes it three-dimensional rather than, I think some people in the White House are one-dimensional thinkers. I think financial markets are two-dimensional, but this opens it up to another dimension. So I think that's what's so important here. And, I'd like to hear the professor talk more about the currency variable that's involved in this, and maybe even NAFTA, because I think this White House is very prone to use the tool of a depreciating dollar to think in their minds that they're going to get more leverage in some of these negotiations.
Yeah, I think the signals being sent by the White House on the currency issue are confusing. President Trump accused China of manipulating its currency to the advantage of Chinese exporters, where the fact is that the renminbi has been strengthening against the dollar. The dollar has been the weak currency recently. What's important in this context is that the administration doesn't control the level of the dollar. The markets do, where the markets take their cue from the Federal Reserve. To be sure, there were some offhanded remarks about the advantages of a weak dollar from Treasury Secretary Mnuchin back in Davos back in January, but I don't think we'll see that repeated. Investors reacted negatively to the Treasury Secretary perhaps trying to talk down the dollar. I think the most we can say here is that currencies will fluctuate. The dollar renminbi exchange rate is not terribly out of line. The Chinese are likely to continue to allow their currency to strengthen modestly against the dollar as a way of diffusing some of these trade tensions. The action is going to be on the side of tariffs and on the side of rhetoric. I think that's where we need to worry.
Do you think there could be other countries employing competitive global currency devaluation as a tool, either from government policies or actions through central banks?
No, I don't really. I think there is a scenario in which other currencies, starting with the euro, depreciate against the dollar because the European Central Bank is raising interest rates less quickly than the Fed. I would not characterize that as currency manipulation. I would characterize that as a side effect of conventional central bank policy tailored to local circumstances. But there is a worry that if the dollar strengthens against the euro and other currencies, that there will be a perception in the West Wing that other countries are manipulating their currencies, and that could feed the kind of trade tensions that we're now seeing.
What about in the European front, Ira? You've written about that in terms of the difficulty.
Well, you know, but let me just raise the issue when Trump did so mistakenly discuss the Russian ruble and the Chinese currency the other day, I wasn't sure whether or not he was poking more at the Fed, because the whole statement was concluded with, while the Fed raises interest rates, which really made the statement ridiculous, because, I mean, historically, when a country is experiencing fiscal stimulus, whether it's right or wrong, and that's a whole different discussion, while it's tightening monetary policy, it ought to, and I stress ought to, be bullish for the currency, at least in the short term. And we've seen nothing of that. So, I mean, that made the Trump statement even that much more ludicrous. But we'll let that one rest. But the European situation is, Richard, I've been on with you many times, and we've discussed this, and it is a mess, and it's getting messier, because now we hear that the relationship between Merkel and Macron is beginning to break down a little bit as Merkel gets more pressure from even the more right wing elements of the CDU and the CSU, let alone the AfD. So she's been more tepid in response. And of course, we have the Italian situation. Now, somebody's been buying Italian debt besides the ECB for the last 5 days, because the differential between 10-year Italian debt and the bonds is now to multi-year lows. The yields are compressing, which is very interesting to me. I'm trying to figure it out from a trader standpoint, what's going on there. And it may be that somebody like China and other large investors are actually buying European debt, but they buy it in a bundle where they'll buy X amount of Italian, they basically build a portfolio, and then they have to believe that that's all money good. And you know what? I'm never sure that anything in Europe is money good forever. So I'm watching this, but things are messy, and we certainly are waiting to see what the Italians come up with as far as forming a government. So that's where it lies for me right now.
And if we look at the trade deficit figures, could some have observed that China may be unnecessarily pointed out in terms of the trade deficit being higher than it actually is? Case in point, some have observed the iPhone in terms of $500 iPhone, approximately $480 of that coming from other countries other than China, where the parts are assembled in China, so that once it comes into the U.S., it's counted as $500 from China, even though there's only $20 in reality from China. I mean, so could politically China be singled out here?
Yes, I think China is being singled out for political and ideological reasons. The president has a trade advisor who's written a book and produced a movie called Death by China. So it's not called Death by Germany or Death by South Korea. China, by its sheer magnitude, sheer scale, makes a big difference in for trade imbalances, even if its current account surplus has come down very significantly from the levels a few years ago. I think the U.S. has real economic grievances with China that are worth pursuing. For example, property rights protection, intellectual property protection, and the way they regulate joint ventures between U.S. companies and their Chinese partners and abscond with the intellectual property at the end of the partnership. The problems are two. Number one, that the U.S. has confused these valid grievances with some spurious ones. The tariffs on imported steel and aluminum on national security grounds made no sense. Little bits of steel and aluminum imported from China don't jeopardize our national security, but they cause people to take their eye off the ball or dismiss as fake news the valid complaints about intellectual property. And secondly, there's the problem that you're going to make progress on China with China on issues like that only by building a coalition of interested countries. That's what explains Trump's brief infatuation with TPP, that he thought it might be a platform for building a coalition of like-minded Asian countries that could put pressure on China. That had been the Obama administration's rationale for going into TPP. And now the president has discovered that TPP has moved on without him, and it no longer includes some of the provisions that the previous White House and Congress would have preferred. So I think that ship has sailed, and that leaves us kind of stranded on our commercial desert island where we're trying to pressure China on intellectual property all by ourselves, and that's hard to do.
Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, there's nothing I can't argue. I think that's absolutely right. But when we're going to get to Europe, because next week, of course, Merkel and Macron are both coming to the U.S. It will be interesting. Now, I would argue that Germany is not on an intellectual property level, but certainly on a financial level, is far a bigger problem than China. You know, if you look at current account surpluses and other things that go with that and other imbalances that exist in the world, but what are you going to accuse Germany of? Having a two-week currency? Again, because that's going to call the question, as Professor Eichengren wrote about in 93, about the whole European edifice, because Germany gets to hide behind a weaker currency and take advantage of it. So I don't know where he's going to go with that. He's going to have Merkel here. That will certainly become an issue. And I think the Europeans, they're actually, I think, happy that the United States is dealing, or at least they're not totally focused on it, but the intellectual property battle, because I think Europe has been very treading very gingerly in attacking China. Every once in a while you hear something and then they recede because China, then some deal gets done. But I think that there's a lot of people in the world who are really happy that the United States is taking on the intellectual property issue with the Chinese. And I think the professor is absolutely right. There would be a coalition of the willing, but they're going to let the United States, as long as he's running around trying to be a sole conciliator of this, you know, they can hide behind it, and that's where we'll go from there. But I'm really looking forward to see how he confronts Merkel next week over the whole trade issues, because he's already attacked Germany, you know, with the autos and everything else. So that's going to get interesting next week.
So just looking at everything, Professor Eichengreen, do you see there to be a morphing into a trade war? And could this result in inflation pressures in the U.S.?
I think there still is a significant risk of things spiraling out of control. Every time the Trump administration threatens China with an additional round of tariffs, $50 billion worth of tariffs on $50 billion worth of imports from China, China responds tit for tat. First, it was $3 billion of iron and steel imports. Then it was $50 billion of assorted imports. And then it became a list of an additional $100 billion of assorted imports. Each time the U.S. threatens to exclude a Chinese company from making an acquisition in the U.S. market, China turns around and threatens to do the same to Qualcomm most recently. So I think it's predictable that they will respond tit for tat. And for this process to end, there have to be quiet negotiations behind the scene, and there has to be restraint from the White House to allow those quiet negotiations to proceed. Is that going to happen? We don't know. So there is a danger here.
Mm-hmm. And Ira?
That's absolutely right. I mean, that's where to go. And it is, if there's one thing with the Chinese, you negotiate in a much more quiet manner, because the Chinese are, look at the first thing, Richard and I know we talked about this months ago, where they were going to go is they were going to attack the ag sector. Why? Because that's an Achilles heel for the Republican Party. The Chinese do their work. These are not, unlike the White House, which goes jumping all over the place. This was a very targeted response to that. Because if these were to take place and the agricultural sector, which are red states, and they were to lose those seats because there was unhappiness, the farm economy right now, I mean, they're always crying. I don't think they're doing it nearly as bad as they're always crying about. But it does have an impact. And you saw it right away. I mean, the response, the Soybean Association, they knew what this was about. So now they even went so far as to the sorghum, which falls into Texas areas. So the Chinese, you know, as I've always maintained, and others certainly agree, they're very astute observers. You know, I always go back to when the Chinese, you know, renminbi was actually devalued January 1st, 1994, the day that NAFTA began. The renminbi was devalued from 5.8 to 8.7, a 50% devaluation. And it was very intelligently done because they knew what NAFTA was about and who was eventually going to be targeted. So I pay very close attention to these Chinese moves because they are very calculated and they're based on deep reasoning rather than just, you know, the exercise of pure power. And they understand the way the global system works for them and against them. So I respect that immensely.
And in terms of the background forces on this, the factors, your recent book, Professor Eichengreen, The Populist Temptation, Economic Grievance and Political Reaction in the Modern Era, to what extent do the thoughts and insight you provided in that book relate to what's happening now on trade issues, trade tariffs, the potential for a trade war?
I think there are plenty of valid complaints about the impact of trade on the U.S. economy, that there are communities and groups of people who have been left behind by globalization and the pressure of import competition. Even more important, I think, however, has been pressure from technology, from robotics, from automation. The reason manufacturing employment has declined is partly Chinese competition, but it's heavily mechanization, that manufacturers are produced by robots and machinery and not so much by people in the 21st century. But the political reality is that it's easier to attack the Chinese than it is to attack the forward march of technology and to argue for rolling back the ladder.
Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I would just, I'm a believer, and I'd like to hear Professor Eichmann talk about, so does that make the Phillips curve irrelevant to the discussion for setting monetary policy? The fact that so much, that capital is mobile on a global basis and can easily access cheaper labor anyway, and cheaper labor tied with advanced mechanization, does that not render the Phillips curve irrelevant for setting monetary policy?
No, I think the Phillips curve is not dead, that it's only been sleeping. I do agree that the Phillips curve has flattened. In other words, wage pressure is less than it used to be at any level of unemployment because of import competition. That, you know, U.S. workers are more concerned about losing their jobs to competition from lower wage countries. But I still think that there comes a point, and we're more or less there, in my view, where the labor market is sufficiently tight and employers are finding it hard, not only in manufacturing, but in the service sector, more broadly in the economy, to find the workers they need at prevailing wages. So they try to attract them by offering somewhat higher wages. With unemployment at 4%, I think we're about to see that. And I think the Fed will have to take that into account.
And finally, could that result in inflationary pressures if we begin to see wage inflation or prices going higher due to the necessity of having to make things more locally in the U.S. Professor Eichengreen?
It could, but I think the more plausible scenario is that it could force the Fed to raise interest rates a little bit faster than the markets anticipate in order to preempt that inflation. And that's where the danger lies, that the markets will be caught off guard. They'll react negatively. And that could affect the broader economy.
And Ira, your final thoughts?
Well, I'm glad we've got to this point, because it was interesting reading Lael Brainard's speech today, because the more I hear her speak, it's like, you know, I get a sense that they would prefer not to raise rates as fast, as they think that they can have an impact too with the counter-cyclical actions, and that's of course building up and maintaining the high capital buffers within the banking system in an effort to slow some of the leveraging and lending that's going on. So, you know, I just find that a very interesting discussion, because there seems to be some reticence to be too aggressive in raising the Fed funds rate. But especially as they're now, you know, as Peter Buchbar would say, quantitative tightening going on, that if they relied on that and, of course, sustaining, not rolling back any of the Dodd-Frank efforts on the capital ratio issue, whether or not that could be as successful as the short-term increase in interest rates. And that's, to me, where this argument goes, which then winds up in the yield curve discussion.
Wow, great insight, gentlemen. How can our listeners learn more about your work? Professor Achengreen, we will post links to your books, but just additionally, is there any website or reference you can provide to our listeners?
Yeah, I'm at the Department of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and there's a webpage for the department and a subpage for me that I try to keep up to date.
Great. And Ira?
Yeah, as usual, Richard, with me, they go to Ira Harris, YRAHARRIS.com, and click on Notes from Underground, where I put out my thoughts on relevant economic and political situations and how they'll affect trading and investing. So that's the best place to catch me.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your great insight.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.